All right, so with that, Professor Ed Boyden is a professor of biological engineering and brain and cognitive sciences at the MIT Media Lab and MIT McGovern Institute. He leads the Synthetic Neurobiology Group, which develops tools for analyzing and repairing complex biological systems, such as the brain, and applies them systematically to reveal ground truth principles of biological function, as well as to repair these systems. These technologies, which are often created in interdisciplinary collaborations, include expansion microscopy, which enables complex biological systems to be imaged with nanoscale precision, optogenetic tools, which enable the activation and silencing of neural activity with light, and optical, nanofabricated, and robotic interfaces that enable recording and control of neural dynamics. He has launched an award-winning series of classes at MIT that teach principles of neuroengineering, starting with basic principles of how to control and observe neural functions, and culminating with strategies for launching companies in the nascent neurotechnology space. He also co-directs the MIT Center for Neurobiological Engineering, which aims to develop new tools to accelerate neuroscience progress. Among many other awards and recognitions, he has received the Breakthrough Prize in Life Sciences in 2016, the Carnegie Prize in Mind and Brain Sciences in 2015, the NIH Director's Pioneer Award in 2013, and the NIH Director's Transformative Research Award twice in 2012 and 2013. He's been named to the World Economic Forum Young Scientist list, the Technology Review World's Top 35 Innovators Under Age 35, and his work was included in Nature Methods Method of the Year in 2010. His group has hosted hundreds of visitors to learn how to use new biotechnologies, and he also regularly teaches at summer courses and workshops in neuroscience and delivers lectures to the broader public, including at TED, at the World Economic Forum, and here at EA Global today. He received his PhD in neurosciences from Stanford University as a Hertz Fellow. Before that, he received 3 degrees in electrical engineering, computer science, and physics from MIT. He has contributed to over 300 peer-reviewed papers, current or pending patents, and articles, and has given over 300 invited talks on his group's work. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ed Boyden.
All right, well, thank you for the invitation and for the very kind introduction. So I direct a group at the MIT Media Lab that's trying to figure out how can we de-risk our approaches to curing diseases. We all, of course, it's almost a truism, would like to end diseases and their unnecessary suffering, but it's such a complicated problem. We often don't know where to begin. And in particular, there's a whole class of diseases that, for all practical purposes, has come to be regarded as intractable. They've been very hard to make progress on in the last many years. These include various kinds of cancers, brain disorders, autoimmune conditions, diseases of aging and development, and so forth, amongst many, many others. Let's just pick as an example brain disorders, which is one of the areas that my group focuses on. Perhaps 1 billion people around the world have experienced some kind of brain disorder, including Alzheimer's disease, or other diseases of the nervous system like Parkinson's or chronic pain and so forth. And of course, these diseases affect not just our time to live, but they can change who we are, how we interact with our loved ones. So a big question, of course, is, well, what can we be doing about these? And it turns out that for treatments for brain disorders, it's been kind of grim. So this is from a 2010 article, and the numbers, I think, are even a bit worse now. But if you're trying to develop a therapy for treating a brain disorder, the failure rate is very high. That is, the failure rate to get the treatment out of the lab and into the clinic, it's over 90%. The cost is enormous. This is 2010 numbers, almost $900 million each. I think more recent numbers have been in the few billion range. And to top it off, the treatments often don't work very well. So this is sort of a worrisome state of affairs. And it turns out that similarly pessimistic numbers hold for many of these other areas of disease that I mentioned. Diseases of cancer, of immunology, of the endocrine system, of the heart, and so forth. It's been very difficult to get new effective therapies out there. And part of the problem, of course, is that these are all diseases that are of incredibly complex body systems that we often don't understand very much about. If you take a look, for example, at the brain, the amount of complexity is enormous. We don't even know how many kinds of cell there are in the brain. New ones are discovered, it seems, every few weeks. And if you were able to zoom into the brain, you would find incredibly complex circuitry. A cubic millimeter of your brain would contain 100,000 cells of many different kinds and connected with perhaps a billion connections between them. So to make things even worse, if you could zoom into those cells, this is obviously just an artistic rendering, you would find thousands and thousands of kinds of biomolecules, different proteins, different products of the genome that are orchestrated in very complex 3D patterns, which of course we don't yet know. So one of the big questions is, well, if we want to understand how to tackle these diseases, maybe we should try to map out what this looks like. Could we de-risk this process of curing a disease or treating a disease by having better knowledge, what you might call ground truth knowledge, of the composition of matter of the body in that disease state? So, of course, therapies begin with an educated guess, a hypothesis. If there are 30,000 genes in the genome and hundreds of thousands of different kinds of biomolecules, a given guess, let's say you build a drug that binds to one of those molecules, of course, is a very tiny space of the entire space of probability. And so one question is, well, how do you maximize the chance that that educated guess or hypothesis is actually true? You know, again, if you have tens of thousands of genes and hundreds of thousands of gene products, what is the chance that that one drug that you build that binds to one target is the very best or even works at all? It's very, very tiny. So one of the hopes is, well, this is a very luck-driven endeavor. You have to make a guess. You have to have a hypothesis. It has to be correct. And perhaps not surprisingly, it's become difficult enough that people have been actually, in some areas of biology and medicine, giving up on such treatments. People have noticed that, for example, in the realm of brain disorders, many pharmaceutical companies have been retracting their interest and moving into areas that they think are more surefire. Or my colleague at MIT, finance professor Andrew Low, published about a year or two ago a series of studies where he talked about how, given the risk of trying to develop a new treatment for a disease like Alzheimer's disease, which is very, very tiny, the chance that it's going to work, that he actually sees there being a lack of interest in industry in going after them, which, of course, is not the right direction that we want to go for. So the question really is, then, how do we turn the development of new medicines into less of a luck-driven process, more of a skill-driven process? You know, there's so many fields of engineering where you can have an idea and you can go implement it, and in a predictable way, in a finite amount of time, you can go make it work. And in medicine, though, you often see where a drug will be developed, and then at a certain stage in clinical trials, it will be revealed to not be efficacious or have side effects that are so daunting that it's not very practical to actually deploy. Now, the transition from luck to skill has happened in other disciplines. So, for example, in the 20th century, there were so many technological triumphs that have been enormously impactful on everyday life. The internet and computers, lasers, you know, all sorts of different ways of traveling, even landing on the moon, as a very famous example. And so one question is, well, why was the 20th century so successful technologically? It seems comparably that in the 21st century, we're not doing so well. And I would hypothesize or put forth the idea that one of the reasons why the 20th century technologies that we have just been talking about were so successful and reliable and impactful in everyday life is that they're built on well-understood physical and scientific principles. So if you look at the laws of physics, there's actually a fairly small number of them. You could fit them on a page if you really wanted. Quantum mechanics and the laws of mechanics and gravity and the laws of electromagnetism. You can actually build off of them very, very reliably. It's not like you're going to have a problem where the science suddenly goes wrong. Now, don't get me wrong. There's still a lot of risk in engineering. There's risk in deployment. There's risk in realization. But the science risk is relatively low. Contrast that with the science risk of biology and medicine. There's just so many variables, so many building blocks in the body, so many kinds of biomolecules that are nanoscale in dimension and organized with nanoscale precision, that one can make a hypothesis, try to take it all the way to the clinic, and the science risk stays high throughout. So one question then is, well, is there a way to reduce the science risk? And of course, if you don't reduce the science risk, then even the kinds of technologies that we're talking about, like landing on the moon and the internet, would not have happened necessarily, right? As a thought experiment, suppose you tried to land on the moon 500 years ago, before we understood gravity and calculus and all of the properties of aerodynamics and rocketry and so forth that's important. Well, you might find people trying to tie kites to chairs or trying to fly hot air balloons in outer space. And if you think about it, all the financial resources on the entire planet would not get you anywhere near the moon. You know, so one of the big questions is, well, how do we accelerate the process of deriving the laws of biology, the laws of medicine? How do we look at those building blocks that are present in brain cells and cancer cells and so forth and understand how they're configured so we could try to build more targeted therapies that can go right for what we want to go for and not have side effects that interfere with everyday life and function? Now, I would postulate that one of the reasons that we need to think about this problem from new angles is that you need new tools if you want to do this. It's not for lack of trying to find the fundamental laws of biology and medicine, but of course, we're always limited by technology. And so if you look at, for example, this microscope that is shown on this picture here, being able to look at very tiny things and to see how life is configured and to understand how the building blocks of cells and organs are organized is really critical. Now, it turns out that microscopes are limited. You can't, on an ordinary microscope, see down to individual molecules and see the receptors and molecules that transmit information from cell to cell that are thought to be so important for the operation of the brain and the body and that go awry in brain disorders and other clinical pathologies. And so one question then is, well, can we build the right kinds of tools? Can we accelerate technology development? And those technologies ideally would give us ground truth understandings of the configurations of complex biological systems. And from those maps of biology, one can then go and develop new targeted therapies. And in this way, you might turn biology and medicine into more mature engineering sciences. So that's the hypothesis that we're trying to put forth about how one might de-risk medicine in a way and make it easier and more predictable to develop new kinds of therapies and treatments and maybe even cures. So this is an exciting time. I think that this kind of agenda is starting to really take place in many different laboratories around the world. Can you build the tools that get down to the fundamental building blocks of life and so we can understand them? And to illustrate this, I just want to talk about one of the many technologies that's emerging in this space, one that my group has been working on, which is to really try to see if we could image, say, cells or tissues or organs down to single molecule precision. So what I have here is a little schematic of a polymer. And what we're going to try to do is to use this polymer to actually physically move apart the molecules of preserved tissues, cancer biopsies, brain circuits, and so forth. And if we can move the molecules apart from each other, maybe you could then actually tell them apart. You could actually make room around them so you could attach little barcodes or other kinds of molecules that indicate identity and location and map the composition of a cell or a cancer cell or a tumor or a brain circuit. So the core idea here comes back to a topic that goes back to half a century, the idea of responsive polymers. And so what you see here is schematized the kind of polymer that you might find, for example, in baby diapers. If you add water, what happens is these tiny nanoscale polymer chains will absorb the water and start to move apart from each other. And so as millions of kids do every day, you know, baby diapers will swell when you add water to them. And that's because the material inside is absorbing water and the polymers inside that material are moving apart from each other. So what if we could do that to a biological specimen? What if we could use this trick to try to push apart all the biomolecules inside a cancer biopsy or a brain circuit or so forth? We need to install those polymers that swell when you add water inside a sample of a cell or a tissue. If we could do that, then you could move those molecules apart from each other until you could tell them apart. So here's the idea that we've been pursuing. You can take Now we've zoomed way in this artistic rendering, into a cell. Each of these brown blobs is a different biomolecule. And the first step that we are trying to do is to attach little handles or anchors to the biomolecules. And these anchors are shown in purple here. If you can attach a little handle to every biomolecule, maybe you could then use that handle to pull them apart from each other. Step two, we can't just dump polymers on top of these samples. We have to install them more subtly. And so what we do is we wash in the building blocks or monomers that make up these polymers, and they form long chains that wind their way around biomolecules and between biomolecules. And every now and then, they'll encounter one of those handles, and now we've attached the biomolecule to the swallowable polymer. The final step, then, is we loosen up the biomolecules from each other so they no longer are bound so tightly to each other. We add water so the polymer chains will swell and move apart, but now the biomolecules come along for the ride. And so the idea here, of course, this is no longer a living system, but you can move the molecules apart from each other until you can actually image them on conventional microscopes, like the one I showed you earlier. And there's also lots of room around these biomolecules. So you can do things like bring in little color codes or barcodes that allow you to understand which molecules are which. So the hope here is that you could actually use this to do things like map brain circuits or cancers and so forth, and figure out what the biomolecules are that are inside and also how they're arranged. You can think of this technology as like, you know, if you drew a picture on a balloon and blows it and you blow it up, the picture gets bigger. Here we're trying to do that, but in three dimensions. So maybe at this point you're wondering, well, that sounds cool in theory, but does it work? And so we made a little time-lapse video here. This is a small piece of brain tissue, preserved, of course. And what you're going to see here is we've already formed the polymer, and now we're going to add water about now. This is a video that's sped up about 60 times, and you can see this piece of brain growing before your very eyes until it gets to the point where it's big enough that you can actually take a picture of very fine structures within on inexpensive optics. So what this lets us do is to actually take, this is a part of the brain that's involved with memory formation, and of course there are many diseases like Alzheimer's disease that corrupt these structures in the brain. And what we're trying to do is to blow up these tissue that we can either obtain from animal models, common in biology, or from human brain tissues, from tissue banks that are maintained by different universities and hospitals. And we can actually swell these tissues to the point where we can see very tiny structures, connections between cells, the organizations of molecules within cells, and understand what kinds of changes are occurring that might be new therapeutic targets that could help us treat brain disorders. Here's a sample of a human breast cancer sample. This is in a collaboration with Andy Beck's group at Harvard. We're also trying to look at tumors. If you can blow up a tumor until you can actually inspect the molecular composition within, you might be able to find out specific targets within those tumors, build drugs that just go for those molecules and not others, and do ultra-targeted destruction of pathological tissues like tumors in the body. In fact, this technology for blowing samples up has proven useful in a variety of other domains. My colleague Ali Katabaseni at Harvard has actually used this technology to blow up bacteria. And then he can actually blow up bacteria big enough to the point where they can take pictures using inexpensive cameras, including modifications of commercially available webcams. So imagine an era where you could actually take a sample of bacteria or viruses or other kinds of pathogens, expand them physically to the point where you could actually take a picture using inexpensive cameras like you find on cell phones, for example. You might imagine a way that you could bring diagnostics into a very, very inexpensive and productive realm to be deployed in the field. So taking a step back, where does this lead us? Well, I hope I've conveyed at least a couple of messages today. Number one, there's so much going on in the body, so many kinds of molecules, that we really need to lower the risk of developing new therapeutics. The risk is just too high, and it's very expensive, and people are actually leaving the development of therapeutics, which is, you know, I think presents us with a moral imperative to figure out how to make the risk lower. Number two, if we look at history, we can see that it is possible to take a risky science and make it into a low-risk science. You have to get down to the ground truth, the fundamental building blocks of the system and how they interact. And through new methods of mapping the building blocks of life, for example, this method of expanding things, one possibility is that we can understand the composition of biological systems and reduce the search space for new kinds of therapeutics for diseases that are complicated and sometimes even intractable. And thirdly, there needs to be better technology. We're always limited by technology in biology and medicine, and through new tools, we can try to accelerate the basic science of understanding the composition of life and what the mechanisms of life and disease are. So thank you very much for your time, and I'm excited to chat with you all about new ways that this will go in the future and brainstorm about other ways that we might de-risk the medical enterprise. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Outstanding. So let's have a seat, and we'll take some questions from the audience. They're coming in here, and I've got my phone, so you can still submit additional questions if you have them. First question, you mentioned the goal of finding and identifying, understanding the laws of biology and the laws of medicine, perhaps even sort of analogous to, of course, the laws of physics. But do we have good reason to think that there are such laws How do you think about whether there are or not, or how complex are they? I mean, can we fit them onto a piece of paper?
That's a great question. So since we haven't yet built all the tools we need to understand all biological mechanisms, it's hard to know if that's going to be the case. Almost certainly, biology is going to be too complicated to, I think, fit on a single sheet of paper. I think we're going to have to create new kinds of software tools to help us comprehend the biological mechanisms that occur. Right now, you see a new set of endeavors where people are trying to make models of cells. And there are too many moving parts to actually hold in one's head, but you can make a computer model. And maybe we need to build better software structures that help us, and software programs that help us understand and mine out the most important processes in cells. As an example, suppose that we can expand a cell, barcode those biomolecules, like I showed during the talk, and now we can try to make a computer model of the processes that occur. I mean, this is a futuristic vision that might take many years to realize, but then you could actually kind of maybe even run little experiments on the cell. Oh, what happens if we perturb this biomolecular pathway? Oh, look, this actually might couple to something downstream. To really do this well, of course, we have to do more than just map the locations of biomolecules. We also need new ways to understand their functions. And that's still a very active area of technology development that many people are trying to work out. Can you screen for, in a high-throughput way, using different assays to understand what a given gene product actually does? And this is a very active area of research right now.
It sounds like this could either go in the direction of being, you know, engineering, or it could almost, you could imagine it turning more like weather, where it's like there's just so much noise in the system that you can't really see beyond a few days out. Even you might have, you know, broad trends in what the weather's doing, but 17 days from now, you know, who can say, right? Do you have any worry about that sort of fundamental noise in the system kind of frustrating the effort to get to laws that you could really sink your teeth into?
Yeah, another great question. So it is true that these complex systems are going to always be affected by noise. And that's one reason why simulations eventually, you know, are hard to predict beyond a certain point. On the other hand, if we look for sort of common structures, you know, it's sort of interesting in some ways that diseases kind of have convergent phenotypes. And what I mean by that is, you know, there are hundreds of different mutations, let's say, or hundreds of different causes that might all converge on a single pathway. You know, if I have a specific condition like schizophrenia or autism or so forth, you know, there are many different potential causes for that, but they might have a common final outcome. And so one hope is that we could find those pathways and find sort of master control switches that might help us overcome these diseases. But this is sort of an unknown at this point. You know, we have to sort of do the work and see what happens.
Gotcha. Another question from the audience. It's recently been in the news, I'm sure you're well aware. There was a bug found in this common open source fMRI analysis package, and it's called into some question a huge amount of research. Any thoughts, reassurances, or maybe the opposite of reassurances that you could offer?
Yeah, well, I think it really highlights the importance of understanding our tools. And one thing that we try to do, of course, is to, you know, if we have a new tool, we try to get into the hands of as many people as possible. We try to get constructive criticism. You know, for this expansion method that I mentioned, we've even started a small startup company. We're just trying to help disseminate in kit form and help it make it available. But we also really welcome feedback. You know, we set up a website where we try to collect feedback, positive and negative, and understand the constraints of the technology. And I think it's very important that technologies be understandable and that they be transparent and accessible to all. And I think there's a real burden of proof on the inventors of technologies to not only make them available, but to make them comprehensible. And I think that's something that is difficult to do, but it can be achieved. So for example, at our group at MIT, we really try to host visitors, you know, all the time to run experiments with us and to really probe new biological medical contexts side by side. We're about to launch in about a week a training course at the Genelia Research Campus near DC in collaboration with Eric Betzig's group to try to help teach to a couple dozen people, many of whom have not experienced these technologies before, these kinds of tools, but also to get feedback. Hey, you know, maybe for certain kinds of clinical contexts, we really need to think about new kinds of variants of technologies to make them work perfectly.
So following up on that question of comprehensibility, in the talk you showed an animation, and in the animation there's, you know, I think you called it an artist rendering of molecules coming into place and interacting with each other, and it struck me that they kind of look like Lego blocks, like snapping into place. And I realize as I'm sitting backstage, I have no idea how realistic that is. Are these, is that a good way to think about it? Are they Lego blocks that kind of snap together and hold together? Or is that a very crude understanding that I should discard?
Yeah. To be honest, we don't really know what life looks like at that scale. You know, we have structures of individual proteins due to technologies like X-ray crystallography, and more recently, the technology of cryo-electron microscopy. We can look at cells, but, you know, cells contain millions and millions of molecules, but you can't see them currently with the resolution that you need. And so with our expansion method, we actually are hoping to see what kinds of structures occur within cells. And are they stereotyped? Can you actually see similar architectures of structures between cells? Or, you know, are they very idiosyncratic from cell to cell? But to be honest, we, you know, the reason that we show these as artist renderings is because we don't have the data yet.
So that leads to a question from the audience, which is, and I'm not sure if there is an answer to it yet, but have we learned anything about cell structure from this expansion technique that has been surprising or particularly interesting so far?
Yeah, absolutely. So the technology is relatively new. We only published the first version of the technology a little bit more than a year ago. And in July of this year, we published a couple of papers showing how to do it in very simple form. So the technology is very, very new. But already, investigators are applying it to topics like looking at tumor samples and or bacterial samples or brain circuits. And for example, by one of the areas that we're exploring is whether you could expand tumors and then after expansion, tell apart cancers or precancerous states that might look, you know, quite similar pre-expansion. But after you expand it, you see more detail. And that's something that we're now exploring very actively. Or in brain circuits, you know, we've been looking at the connections between neurons or synapses and looking at different proteins that are located on each side of that connection. And with regular microscopy, it's very hard to see how they're organized, but we can already start to see patterns. You know, some synapses are, you know, have distributions of proteins that are quite close, and other ones have those distributions much farther apart, which raises the question, you know, are these connections silent? Are they reserving their machinery for some kind of later usage? Like when a memory has been expressed, then you activate them? And so we're hoping that because these technologies are easy to deploy and don't require any special hardware, we can start to really be much more exploratory about the nanostructure of life.
Yeah, it's interesting. That also leads to another question from the audience. You're describing something that, to me, sounds like pulling things apart, and indeed that, you know, that is physically what it is, but then also looking in very specific ways and trying to understand very specific things. So an audience question was, do you think that machine learning has a role to play in your work? Is there some sense in which you can throw the data into, you know, a black box and have it tell you what's happening as opposed to trying to look one by one at the
individual
mechanisms?
So this is sort of synergistic with the question that we talked about earlier, which is what is understanding and will we actually get laws of biology? The sheer quantity of data and also the diversity of the kinds of things you would see in these biological data sets, I think, will benefit from machine learning. And this is something we've started to explore a little bit. You know, our group has been more of a molecular group for many years, but now we're starting to dip our toes in this area. As a concrete example, suppose that you could expand different samples of cancers or other clinical tissues. We would want to classify them and understand whether there might be more subcategories of a disease than people had previously anticipated, right? If we understood that one disease is actually 10 kinds of diseases, that might help us refine our abilities to treat more focusedly and not use, you know, a one-size-fits-all approach that actually doesn't fit all. Or a second example is, you know, one of the areas I'm very excited about is also if we see these nanostructures of molecules as they're configured in 3D space, can we find common motifs? You know, if the molecules are all randomly organized, that'll be disappointing, but it'll be good to know. But we might be able to mine out different patterns of how these molecules are organized and understand how one configuration might be normal and one pathological. And I think that we'll find some very interesting clues in that area. I'll give you a concrete example. There's so many diseases where proteins aggregate. So Alzheimer's disease, we see these amyloid plaques, Huntington's disease, Parkinson's, and so forth. There are many conditions where proteins do not form normal structures. And so one question is, well, what's around them? Is something causing them to form these structures? Are they self-assembling? We don't really know. But I think that we're going to find out some interesting things, and here's why. In all of these diseases, some cells in the brain are more affected than others. And so that might be a clue that maybe some cells have precipitating factors or environments that sort of foster a pathological state and others don't. And if we can actually understand what causes, for example, in ALS, some motor neurons to die off, but others are relatively fine, the ones that move our eyes, we might be able to actually understand what causes these degenerative states to emerge, and it might very well be due to, you know, changes in the architecture of these cells at the protein level.
You're encyclopedic about this. We could go on all day, but we're at just about the end of time. Maybe the last question for those that want to explore kind of your fundamental motivation more in the concept of de-risking progress.
Yeah.
What other areas would you recommend that people look into to see where people are working to de-risk progress?
Yeah, well, I'm really very interested in the question of how do we build new tools that help us get down to the ground truth descriptions of biology. You know, in Kevin's talk, we just heard about CRISPR, you know, a very precise way of editing the genome. And I think that biology is very technology-driven, and the technologies are coming from all sorts of different areas of science and engineering, very often unpredicted, right? CRISPR emerged from studies of very, very basic bacterial processes that, at the beginning, probably had no hope of any practical application. The polymers we use to expand tissues and make them large enough to see, those have their roots in basic chemistry and physics going back half a century. And so what I'm very excited about is catalyzing serendipity. Can we help connect dots across different disciplines of science and engineering to help people meet and help catalyze these connections to build tools that will help us get down to these fundamental descriptions of biology? And I think that's one of the most exciting areas, and it's very hard to predict. That's part of why it's so fun, and it's a bit of an art form to bring people together in these teams to really build these transformative technologies.
So the only way to do that is the way that you're doing it, which is to be deep in at least one area and to go a lot of places and invite a lot of people to your lab and sort of make those connections happen between people. Is that
I think that's really powerful, yeah. You know, if you look at a lot of the transformative technologies that have revolutionized our understanding of biology and therefore have contributed very heavily to the development of better, really targeted medicines, they've often come from the most obscure parts of science. You know, the green fluorescent protein, which has been used in, I don't know, a million studies now to label proteins, and you can watch them move around in cells, that came from studies of jellyfish. You know, again, CRISPR came from bacteria, a technology that our group used to work on a lot, and we still do a little bit in optogenetics, where we control the brain with light, that came from studies of microbes that live in very high salt, you know, concentration, watery environments, you know, such as, you know, some parts of San Francisco Bay. So I think what we need to do is to really connect the dots between these different areas of science, and those are going to yield these transformative technologies. It's very hard to think of a transformative technology. You kind of have to stumble across it and connect dots, and then have the wisdom to realize that something important has happened, and then move forward in terms of validation and deployment. And so that's a role that I hope to be able to play some humble role in contributing to in the years to come, is connecting engineers and scientists in combinations so we can try to build these transformative tools.
You're off to an amazing start. Professor Ed Boyden, thank you very much.
I really appreciate it.